the 27th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 55, imaginatively titled Restoration of the Church to Episcopacy. Okay, well, last time we had discussed how the new Scottish Parliament, that was new in the 1600s, not new in the last few years, had overthrown many of the gains the Covenanters had made by law, as well as how persecution of some of the ministers continued. We looked a little bit on an anecdotal basis at the state of Scotland in the mid-17th century, and how the Covenanters were not dour killjoys. Although, a little later they may seem, they'll certainly be dour, but that's another story. Today we're going to discuss how the overthrow goes on within the church itself. It goes on quite a bit within the church through legal means or into extra legal means. But if you remember, those of you who sat in the first part of the class, James had a series of machinations to convert the Presbyterian Church into an Episcopalian church. And we sometimes laughed that he wasn't very subtle doing things like changing the vote on General Assembly votes or changing what the wording of the motion had been, that sort of thing, bribing representatives and all that. Well, this is Charles is even less subtle, if that's possible. If attitudes sometimes swing like pendulums, right, we're in the far swing towards absolute monarchy in England and Scotland. It had swung quite far the other way, right? Charles I finally getting his head cut off. But that's probably also what got the pendulum swinging the other way. Certainly, if we look back to Scotland, as soon as news was received that he'd been executed, they proclaimed Charles II to be king, and there was a lot of royalist sympathy. Okay, so today it's maybe sometimes difficult to keep the players straight with a scorecard, so we'll start with the scorecard. Okay, the Earl of Middleton, we've mentioned, was the King's Commissioner to Parliament. He would be in Scotland whenever Parliament was being held, and likely back in London in between times to either receive instructions or to give an account of what had happened. Going back a few years, he had led a royalist uprising at the time of the Argyll administration. He was a vicious, greedy drunkard. Gilbert Burnett said his way of living was very splendid, but at the same time very scandalous. For vices of all kinds, especially prodigious drinking, were the open practices of those about him. And such as had seen the piety and gravity that appeared in the former administration began to look with an evil eye on everything that was done by such a set of lewd libertines. Okay, and this is an Episcopalian writing. Lauderdale, John Maitland, the grandnephew of the Maitland that was secretary to Mary Queen of Scots, was the Earl Lauderdale. He was Charles' Secretary of State for Scotland. He actually spent most of his time then in London handling Scottish affairs. He had been at one time a Covenanter, the lay representative for the Westminster Assembly. He was then in turns one of the engagers who had actually negotiated the engagement with Charles. He'd been captured in the Battle of Worcester and spent 9 years in the Tower of London and other English castle prisons. According to Maurice Lee, he spent the time there mostly reading. He was said by one of his contemporaries to be the greatest scholar, the greatest statesman that was a scholar and the greatest scholar that was a statesman. In fact, later, a little bit later in life, one of his houses was in danger of collapsing due to all the books on the second story. Yeah, see that? Yeah. I'll read you a little bit of Gilbert Burnett's description of him. The Earl of Lauderdale, afterwards made Duke, had been for many years a zealous Covenanter, but in the year 47 he turned to the King's interest, and at Worcester fight was taken prisoner and detained in custody till the affair of the Restoration was set on foot. In his person he made but an ill appearance. His stature was large, his hair red, his tongue too big for his mouth, and his whole manner rough and boisterous and very unfit for a court. His temper was intolerable, for he was haughty beyond expression to all who had expectances from him, but abject where himself had any, and so violently passionate that he oftentimes, upon slight occasions, ran himself into fits like madness. His learning was considerable, for he not only understood Latin, in which he was a master, but Greek and Hebrew. Had read a great deal of divinity, almost all historians, both ancient and modern, and having besides an extraordinary memory, was furnished with a copious but very unpolished way of expression. The sense of religion that a long imprisonment had impressed on his mind was soon erased by a course of luxury and sensuality which ran him into great expense, and which he stuck at nothing to support. And the fury of his behavior heightened the severity of his ministry and made it more like the cruelty of an inquisition than the legality of justice. After all, he was no lover of popery or arbitrary power, but retained his aversion to King Charles I and his party to the hour of his death, for he was the coldest friend and the most violent enemy that ever was known. Then in the unabridged, this is the abridged version of Burnet, in the unabridged version, he says, he was in his principles much against popery and arbitrary government, and yet by a fatal train of passions and interests, he made way for the former and had almost established the latter. Whether he was seduced from his covenanter convictions earlier, or whether he was an opportunist who was happy to act as a covenanter in the when they were in power, it's difficult to know for sure. I think there's, I guess, different people have different opinions on the matter. But he was not in some kind of ignoramus or anything like that. And yet he did, despite that, he ended up being, eventually becoming a persecutor of the Covenanters. James Sharp. Of Sharp, we've heard much already. He was the representative of the Resolutioners. We've said often how duplicitous he was in his dealings, although we really haven't pointed to too much evidence other than he became, when the change came upon the church, he was the archbishop. Turns out that later, Lauderdale and Sharp were at odds with each other, and Lauderdale was able to disgrace Sharp by doing the following. Lord Lauderdale got many of his letters, which he had wrote to the Presbyterians, Sharp, after the time he was negotiating for episcopacy, in which he continued to protest with what zeal he was soliciting their concerns, not without dreadful imprecations upon himself if he did prevaricate with them. These he laid before the king. Okay, so Lauderdale put these before the king. And from that time forward, the king looked on him, or Sharp, as one of the worst of men. So, at least in the contemporaries, there was a pretty strong evidence of his duplicity. Lauderdale and Middleton were at odds with each other. Lauderdale was a leader of what Maurice Lee refers to as the Scottish Moderates. Okay, it shouldn't be taken to mean that they necessarily favor Presbyterianism, although some of them did. But in his case, at least, he favored a moderate course in introducing episcopacy. He opposed the Recisory Act. And when Charles became resolute on establishing episcopacy, Lauderdale still thought it was worth consulting the Presbyterian synods and thought that public opinion should be better prepared for introduction of episcopacy. He was maybe you might say he was a political realist. Middleton, on the other hand, was part of what Lee calls the extremists, these men who were allied to Charles's Lord High Chancellor, Edward Hyde, the Earl of Clarendon. They stood for absolute monarchy, revenge, and profiting in office by fining and confiscating the estates of their enemies. With one exception, through Clarendon's influence, all of the high offices in Scotland went to extremists. Middleton was the king's commissioner. The Earl of Glencairn became the chancellor. The Earl of Rothes became president of the Privy Council. The one exception, the Earl of Crawford, was said to be a staunch Presbyterian. He was later forced out of office, actually within about a year and a half or so. He was forced out of office because he refused to take this oath that Parliament had required that to denounce the covenants. So, all this is a lot of politics. What effect does it have on the church? Well, one dynamic is that because Charles's advisors in the sort of ascendancy were the Clarendon and the Extreme Party, Lauderdale didn't have as much influence as he might have to have a sort of moderate policy. And, you know, who knows, but the whole course of history might have been different if that had been different. This is Maurice Lee, who says, Lauderdale did not want to bring back the Canterburyan Times, as Bailey mistakenly assumed, referring to a letter written by Robert Bailey. But he fully expected the bishops and their supporters to make a mess of things. After the turmoil of the past 25 years, there was a chance that a moderate and gradually introduced episcopal structure could have won general acceptance. And in fact, many Presbyterian clergy did accept the new system. Nonconformity was largely concentrated in the Southwest. Lauderdale, however, was determined that his judgment should be vindicated, and so he allowed the prelates and their Clarendonian supporters a free hand, contenting himself with an occasional protest for the record. In 1664, for example, Archbishop Sharp proposed the creation of a special commission to enforce religious legislation. Lord Lauderdale, he's quoting Burnett, but Lord Lauderdale saw that this would prove a high commission court, yet he gave way to it, though much against his mind. When Burnett protested about this, Lauderdale explained, it was the policy of enough rope. He was persuaded he, Sharp, would ruin all, but he said he was resolved to give him line, for he had not credit enough to stop him. Things would run to a height, and then the king would have himself put a stop to their career. And so indeed it turned out. So, you know, in God's providence, the people who were the most severe had the upper hand, and were trying to force episcopacy down everyone's throat. You know, it's quite possible a more moderate course might have succeeded in slowly seducing Presbyterians, but you know, if that's not the way it happened. Okay, the king had earlier promised that there would be no change in the church government in Scotland, but church leaders started to get suspicious when the Act Recessory, which is what they called it, but we usually call it the Recessory Act, was being considered. First of all, church leaders in Edinburgh went to Middleton informing him of the impact it would have on the statutes that established the covenants in the Westminster Assembly, or the Westminster Standards. Middleton, as Hewison says, politely cajoled the deputation until he got time to have the statute passed. In April of 1661, the Synod of Fife met to prepare a petition to the King's Commissioner, and they were going to ask for an act to be passed that would establish the Scottish Church as Presbyterian. But they, after they'd gotten started, the Earl of Rothes, one of the extremists, who was also quite possibly the worst speller ever to achieve high political office, according to Lee, and with whom, according to Hewison, Airy, extortion appears to have been the only object and brutality the only method. He stood up and ordered the Synod to desist and disperse, which they did. The Synod of Dumfries was dissolved by the Earls of Queensberry and Hartfell. The Synod of Galloway was dispersed by the Earl of Galloway. They had prepared, again in the words of Hewison, a prolix wild Whig manifesto in favor of covenants and uniformity. In their case, they were definitely out of touch. The uniformity they were pushing would be to make all the English churches Presbyterian. Okay, in other synods, the battles between protesters and resolutioners, maybe it's not right to say the battles went on, but these tensions continued. In the Synod of Glasgow and Ayr, William Guthrie of Fenwick, that's my fellow duck hunter and fly fisherman, tried to get the Synod to petition the king. He was opposed by three ministers, and so they didn't end up sending the petition. Those three ministers later became the bishops of Galloway, the Isles, and Dunblane. In the Synod of Ross, a minister was deposed, an elder was suspended for refusing to disown the protestation. So, very quickly, you know, in the early stages of the parliamentary transformation, the church was quickly silenced by a show of force. Um, you to get some insight into the covenanter reaction, you might read Robert Bailey's letter. This is that. Actually, this is the one that Lee was reacting to. Okay, after telling him that the bearer of the letter would promise either to deliver it or burn it, he says, "I tell you that my heart is broken with grief, and that the burden of the public, I find it weighty in hastening me to the grave. My prayers daily when my heart is loosed are for the King and you, for his blessing on you both. I have no private desires nor fears, but I think we are very ill-guided, and very needlessly so. What needed you do that disservice to the King, which all of you cannot recompense, to grieve the hearts of all your gracious friends in Scotland, to whom the King was, is, and will be, I hope, after God, most dear, with pulling down all our laws at once which concerned our church since 1633. Was this good advice, or will this thrive? Is it wisdom to bring back upon us the Canterburyan times? The same designs, the same practices, will they not at last bring on the same horrible effects? Whatever fool's dream. The old maxim of the state of England is wise and good." This goes right to the heart of the resolutioner philosophy. "That the king can do no fault, but the highest ministers of state ought in all reason to answer on their highest pain for all miscarriages. It was one of James's wisest practices to permit his greatest favorites to sink, before that, by protecting them, the grief of his people should fall on his back. You have seen the contrary principle destructive, and it will still be so. Let's see. My lord, you are the nobleman of the world I esteem most and love best. I think I may say and write to you what I like. If you have gone with your heart to forsake your covenant, to countenance the introduction of bishops and books, and strengthening the king by your advice in these things, I think you a prime transgressor and liable among the first to answer to God for that great sin, and opening a door which in haste will not be closed for persecution of a multitude of the best persons and most loyal subjects that are in all the three dominions." Certainly right on that score. "And if otherwise your heart be where it was, as I hope indeed it is, and that in your own way you are doing what you can for the truth of God, yet daily I have my great fears for you. I think you stand in a ticklish place, and some of these you do converse with to be but men. Remember your cousin Hamilton's poisoning before King James's eyes without search. My heart trembles for you. I will continue to pray for you, do what you will. Mr. Guthrie, I ever opposed his way." Okay, this is before Guthrie was sentenced to death. "But see that none get the king persuaded to take ministers' heads. Banishment will be worse for them than death. How shall they get bread if put without the bounds of the English language? Send them to Orkney, or any other place where they may preach and live. You may obtain this, I think, if you will." Okay, he then goes on to his situation. He's now been appointed principal of the University of Glasgow and is now stuck with the debts that he claims his predecessor laid upon him. And he closes with, "If you or Mr. Sharp, whom we trusted as our own souls, have swerved toward Chancellor Hyde's principles, as now we see many do, you have much to answer for. This possibly may be my last to you, therefore I crave no pardon for its length or impertinency." So, you can see Bailey is still somewhat deceived, but he can read the handwriting on the wall, as it were. After the first post-Restoration Scottish Parliament finished meeting in July of 1661, the Earl of Middleton and the other leaders of Parliament went down to meet with the King. They and the King and the Earl of Clarendon debated what to do about the church. Middleton, Glencairn, and Rose, our extremists, argued for episcopacy. Lauderdale suggested a middle course of consulting the ecclesiastical courts first. One of the other moderates there, Hamilton, reminded the King of his promise to continue the church in its Presbyterian form of government, or in its form of government established by law. They decided to write the Privy Council in Scotland to seek advice, but the Earl of Glencairn had already arranged what the answer would be when they did that, and that was that Scotland was for episcopacy. The debate was finished with the Earl of Clarendon saying, "God preserve me from living in a country where the church is independent from the state and may subsist by their own acts, for there all churchmen may be kings." And drink their Diet Pepsi as they please. Okay, accordingly, Charles resolved to set up episcopacy. He instructed Lauderdale to write to the Privy Council on the 14th of August, conveying our firm resolution to interpose our royal authority for restoring of that church to its right government by bishops. He also ordered that no synod meetings be held. The Privy Council met on the 5th of September, and a few members thought they should ask the king to reconsider and consult with the synods first. Okay, but they didn't carry the council, being dominated by extremists. And the next day, the edict was proclaimed at the Market Cross in Edinburgh. In addition to proclaiming church government by bishops that the king would appoint, their proclamation also banned all objectors and ordained all magistrates to commit all nonconformists to prison. So now the meaning of a letter written by Lauderdale and Sharp in the king's name, proclaiming the king's intention in August of 1660, "We do also resolve to protect and preserve the government of the Church of Scotland, as it is settled by law without violation," was now known. Since the letter had been written, the Act for Cicely had been passed, so the way Church of Scotland was government was settled was by the law that was the same, the law that was now in existence, which was the law prior to 1640. Offers of bishoprics were made to the leading resolutioners, including Douglas, Bailey, Wood, Dixon, and others. Although they didn't accept, almost all of the bishops were resolutioners. I think there was at least one case where it was an old bishop who had left Scotland at the time of the Second Reformation. Okay, so Thomas Sidsurf returned. But other than that, they were basically all resolutioners. Douglas had, was approached by Sharp to be possibly recruited as the Archbishop of St. Andrews. Okay, now clearly this was a position Sharp wanted, but I guess maybe politically he tried to recruit Robert Douglas. Douglas had previously written to Sharp that we must leave that business to the Lord, who will root out that stinking weed in his own time, whatever pains men may take to plant it and make it grow, referring to episcopacy. After it became clear that Sharp was going to fail in his mission to recruit Douglas, and, you know, too bad, but he would have to be the Archbishop of St. Andrews then. Douglas told him, "James, I see you will engage. I perceive that you are clear. You will be Bishop of St. Andrews, and take it and the curse of God with it." Okay, on the 14th of November, 1661, Sharp was appointed to the Metropolitan See of Scotland to be the Archbishop of St. Andrews, the premier prelate of Scotland. I guess I'd hope to do a little more background on this, but there were in Scotland there were two archbishops. The other one was Andrew Fairfull, who was Archbishop of Glasgow. And then in addition, I think there were another 12 bishops. Two of them were appointed on that day. On the 15th of December, the four of them were consecrated by English bishops in Westminster Abbey. This was after Sharp and Leighton, one of the bishops, who had never been ordained in a pre-covenants Episcopal church, had to be first ordained as priests and deacons. Sharp protested. You know, he thought that his ordination as a Presbyterian minister would be good enough, but I guess he relented. So, in the spring of 1662, in roughly April, the four bishops traveled north to Scotland. Although when Robert Leighton found out that they were planning a triumphal entry into Edinburgh, he asked to be let off early and made his own way separately. Robert Leighton was probably the one bishop that wasn't a complete scoundrel. Okay, once they returned to Scotland, they in turn ordained and consecrated another 10 bishops, so that in addition to the two archbishops, there were 2 archbishops and 12 bishops in total. They generally tended to be of relatively low moral quality, but they were acceptably loyal to the king. As Douglas says, some had former injuries to avenge as well as immediate contempt and insult to withstand. And in the words of Hewison, the hierarchy was now equipped for its mission, which turned out to be a militant one, late in confessing it was fighting against God, and multitudes of his countrymen resisting the bishops as their natural enemies. Okay, so five of the remaining bishops were, I guess the word is, consecrated on the 7th of May, 1662. The next day, that they and the four who had been previously consecrated took their seats in the second post-Restoration Scots Parliament. This was the very first act of that Parliament was to pass an act which restored the bishops to membership in Parliament, and then they marched them in with a lot of pomp and circumstance. The second Parliament then proceeded further in the same directions as the first Parliament. In addition to restoring the bishops and archbishops to parliamentary membership, they passed an act for restitution and reestablishment of the ancient government of the church by archbishops and bishops. And a little bit of a quotation from that act. For as much as the King's Majesty hath been gracious... The first one was the first act. We'll skip over that. Second act. For as much as the ordering and disposal of the external government and policy of the church doth properly belong unto His Majesty as an inherent right of the crown, by virtue of His royal prerogative and supremacy in causes ecclesiastical, and in discharge of this trust, His Majesty and His Estates of Parliament, taking to their serious consideration that in the beginning of and by the late rebellion within this kingdom in the year 1637, the ancient and sacred order of bishops was cast off. Ancient and sacred, you know, it's so ancient that they were introduced in the beginning of the 1600s, but okay. Their persons and rights were injured and overturned in a seeming parody among the clergy, facetiously or factiously and violently brought in, to the great disturbance of the public peace, the reproach of the Reformed religion, and violation of the excellent laws of the realm for preserving an orderly subordination in the church. Okay, and then goes on to complain about all the more things about the government. But it legally reestablished the church to be governed by archbishops and bishops. Another act for preservation of the Majesty's person and government was drawn so that to embrace every kind of treason conceivable, and declared all the official doings throughout the covenanting epoch from 1638 to 1660 to be illegal. All bonds made or to be made, including the National Covenant and Solemn League and Covenant, to be unlawful, and the General Assembly of Glasgow to have been treasonable. This is the one where the church overthrew the government by bishops, deposed a bunch of them. Inhibiting all persons in rebellion by word, writing, or deed against regal and ecclesiastical authority, and declaring all offenders against these provisions to be incapable of civil employment. They have then followed with another act where persons in public trust were to make a declaration acknowledging that the covenants were unlawful and not obligatory. And this was an attempt to get rid of Lauderdale and Crawford, the treasurer. And they were successful in getting rid of Crawford. He wouldn't swear this oath, and he was deposed from office. Lauderdale, on the other hand, told someone he would swallow a cartload of oaths before. So there was an act explicitly against the covenants. Um, more along the same lines. The Estates of Parliament taking into their consideration the miseries, confusions, bondage, and oppressions this kingdom have groaned under since the year 1637, with the causes and occasions thereof. And since the rise and progress of the late troubles did in a great measure proceed from some treasonable and seditious positions infused into the people, that it was lawful to subjects for reformation to enter into covenants and leagues or to take up arms against the king or those commissionated by him and such like, and considering that as the present age is not fully freed of these distempers, so posterity may be apt to relapse therein if timeous remede not be provided. Therefore, declare that those positions, it's lawful, to enter into leagues and covenants or take up arms, etc., those things are rebellious and treasonable, and that all these gatherings, convocations, petitions, protestations, and erecting and keeping of council tables that were used in the beginning and for carrying on of the late troubles were unlawful and seditious, and particularly that these oaths whereof the one was commonly called the National Covenant, and the other entitled a Solemn League and Covenant, were and are in themselves unlawful oaths, and were taken by and imposed upon the subjects of this kingdom against the fundamental laws and liberties of the same. Okay, and that there lieth no obligation upon any of the subjects of the said oaths, or either of them, to endeavor any change or alternation of government either in church or state. And therefore annuls all acts and constitutions, ecclesiastic or civil, approving the said pretended National Covenant or League and Covenant, or making any interpretations of the same or either of them. That was complete. So covenant's completely thrown out. There's an act against conventicles. Okay, now, for the most part, I don't think conventicles had become an issue yet, but apparently they were wise enough to see that the conventicles would become an issue. His Majesty, considering that under the pretext of religious exercises, diverse unlawful meetings and conventicles, the nurseries of sedition, have been kept in private families, hath thought fit, with advice and consent of his states convened in this present Parliament, hereby to declare that as he doth and will give all due encouragement to the worship of God in families, amongst the persons of the family, and others who shall occasionally, or shall be occasionally there for the time, so he doth hereby discharge all private meetings or conventicles and houses. Okay. And that was later to be one of the main themes of the next 28 years, is that private meetings outside the established church would be, people attending those would be hunted down and killed. Another act stripped rebels and their families of everything necessary for existence, and even asking for mercy on the rebels made yourself liable to prosecution for disloyalty. Okay, so that, and again, we'd see later, but also throughout the next 20-some years, again and again, the government would deprive people of all their belongings, take everything. The 80th Act offered an indemnity, pardon, and oblivion to many rebels, okay, with special exceptions for about 800 persons. And those 800 persons were supposed to be able to pay heavy fines between 200 and 16,000 pounds Scots, and the total of the fines was nearly 2 million pounds. I don't know what that is in today's dollars, but it's a lot of money. Okay, finally, the Earl of Middleton, though, overreached himself with what was called the Billeting Act. It was really an additional clause to this act of indemnity. But the idea was that there would be 12 people who would be banned from office. But those 12 people would be voted on by the secret balloting process. And then the list would be given to the king, and then he would, act on it if he chose to. But then they spread the word that the king, who he wanted to get rid of, was Lauderdale and all the other moderates. So the members of Parliament would be doing the king a favor by voting to ban Lauderdale and so on. So when the king found out what had happened, he fired Middleton. Well, he transferred him to the governorship of Tangiers. So, and he died shortly thereafter. Okay, the day after the Parliament closed, they left the Privy Council to do some of their dirty work. The Privy Council met and ratified a resolution of the bishops to meet with their clergy in the various dioceses. Dioceses? However you say that. I don't know. Diocese? Isn't that the singular? What's the plural? Oh. Well, whatever. Okay. Well, wherever they were supposed to meet. Ministers who refused to meet were to be held to be contemners, people who had contempt of authority and liable to censure. And those convening religious meetings were to be certified as seditious. Okay, not many of the ministers met with their bishops, and when Middleton and a number of the members of the Privy Council toured the southwest of Scotland, where they expected the most trouble, ending in Glasgow to see Archbishop Fairfall, they found that very few ministers had recognized this new authority. Let's see here. Okay, so after they arrived, this is from, I'm going to read a little bit from Hewson. When this Archbishop Fairford informed the court that they, you know, there'd been few ministers show up, he was asked to suggest a remedy, and he proposed that a peremptory order be issued enjoining all pastors to submit to authority forthwith or quit their manses and remove into other presbyteries. He acted on the supposition that the clergy, having flexible consciences, would rather comply than suffer, and that no more than 10 pastors would be obstinate. The Magdalen legislators, fired with this inspiration, met in the Four College Hall on 1st October, and, heedless of the consequences, authorized an edict of eviction to this effect. Ministers who have not obeyed the recent acts shall forthwith cease the exercise of their ministry. Their pulpit shall be declared vacant, parishioners are relieved from payment to them of stipend, and from acknowledgement of their ministry on pain of being convicted as conventiclers. Non-compliers shall remove beyond the bounds of the presbytery before 1st of November. Neglectors of the anniversary thanksgiving shall be mulcted in 1 year stipend and be liable to the full penalty fixed by the act. That's for refusing to celebrate Restoration Day. They all signed the ordinance, and the Duke of Hamilton informed Burnet that they were all so drunk that day that they were not capable of considering anything that was laid before them, and would hear of nothing but the executing of the law without any relenting or delay. So the ministers were now in even a worse case than the civil servants of the crown, who had in their declaration to repudiate the covenanted work of Reformation, because the stipends in grain were not yet converted into money, and the non-conforming ministers had to leave their homes in winter. Okay, they had a recent noble precedent in the action of 2,000 English clergy who on St. Bartholomew's Day preferred eviction to conformity. So great indeed was the number of the pastors of Scotland who refused compliance that the majority of the council, on becoming sober, grew alarmed at their own headstrong mistake. Middleton raged and cursed at having been befooled and endeavored to get the archbishops to contrive, for the good of the people, some way of undoing the evil effects of the order. Fairfall was in no hurry to retract. Sharp professed to be shocked at the proclamation, nor did he imagine that so rash a thing could have been done till he saw it in print. His method was to break his opponents one by one. The council at their first meeting on 23rd December authorized another proclamation by which the rigor of their former order was mitigated, and ministers were indulged until 1st February to obtain legalized presentation and collation, but were ordered to stay in their own parishes, while wanderers from their own parish churches were ordered to be fined in 20 shillings Scots, and extra parochial gatherings at communions or holy fairs were proclaimed as a special engine to debauch people from their duty. This respite was a convenience to very few waverers. Okay, estimates of the total number of ministers ejected vary, the most detailed analysis that I've seen suggests that out of 880 charges that weren't vacant at the time, there were about 72 that were vacant, 329 ministers were deprived of their livings, and then 551 accepted episcopacy. I'm hoping, I think next week I might go over some individual cases, but I thought the Burnett's summary of this was very interesting. Now keep in mind, this is Bishop Gilbert Burnett, who's an Episcopalian, and he does have some a fair amount of bias against the Presbyterians, but still interesting. The former incumbents, in other words, the Presbyterian ministers, were a grave, solemn sort of people. Their spirits were eager and their tempers sour, but they had an appearance that created respect. They were related to the chief families in the country, either by blood or marriage, and had lived in so decent a manner that the gentry paid them great respect. They used to visit with their parishioners much, to live in great familiarity with them, and in matters of religion to make them their partners, as it were, and companions. They were so full of the Scriptures, and so ready at extemporary prayer, that from thence they grew to practice extemporary sermons, and their method of preaching was so clear in raising observation on points of doctrines out of the text, then proving these observations by reasons, and so showing the use that was to be made of the whole for instruction and terror, for exhortation and comfort, for trial of themselves, and for furnishing them with proper helps and directions, that the people could follow a sermon through every branch of it with a small retention of memory. They kept scandalous persons under very severe discipline. For a breach of the Sabbath, an oath, or the least disorder and drunkenness, persons were cited before the church session, which consisted of 10 or 12 of the chief of the parish, together with the minister, more solemnly reproved for it. For fornication, they were 3 Sundays successively, and in the time of divine service, seated on a high place in the church called the stool or pillar of repentance, there to receive exhortations and make professions of their sorrow for their sin. But for adultery, they were to sit 6 months in that place, covered with sackcloth. These things had a grave appearance, and in conjunction with the pains they took in their parishes, gained them great reverence and esteem. For their faults and defects were not so conspicuous, though they were men of no learning, little capacity, much passion and indiscretion. Affected in their deportment, and very apt to censure those who differed from them, superstitious and haughty in their temper, but servile and ready to fawn upon all who did admire them. In their sermons, railers at courts and governments, and in their principles of church independency, sowers of strife and fomenters of sedition. Now, I don't buy all the stuff that Burnett says, and I think a lot of it you can read more than one way. In any case, the ministers had, for many months before their ejection, been infusing into their people that all was designed in the change of church government was to destroy the power of godliness and to give an impunity to vice. The prelacy was a tyranny in the church set up by ambitious and covetous men, who aimed at nothing but authority and wealth, luxury and idleness, and to procure to themselves a party among the impious and immoral. These suggestions, with what the people saw of the Earl of Middleton's extravagances while he was among them, and with what they heard of Sharpe's treachery to those who had employed him, and the rest of the bishop's prevarication, wrought very strong prejudices in them, which the weakness and wickedness of the new incumbents tended mightily to confirm. And these are the new ministers. For they were the worst preachers that ever were heard, ignorant to a reproach, and many of them openly vicious, a disgrace indeed to their function, and the very dregs and refuse of the North. And of the few who rose above contempt and scandal, their tempers were so violent they were so as much hated as the others were despised. These were the fatal beginnings of restoring episcopacy in Scotland, and the success could not well be expected to be prosperous where such incompetent agents were employed in the work. Okay, so, again, this isn't an Episcopalian, a bishop, and even though he runs down the Presbyterians, I think if you read carefully, there's a lot of things that are actually quite positive. He didn't, and then when he speaks about compared to the Episcopalian ministers, they were real jewels. So, okay, well, I think we'll stop right there. And questions, Bruce.
The Episcopalian Church today still holds the king as the queen or as the head of the church?
Yes.
Yeah.
The king and queen
are
still crowned by
the council. Yeah. Right. Although Charles, the prince who I guess will be Charles III, maybe, said he wanted to be upholder of the faith, and upholder of the faith. So, but yes, they still today are head of the Anglican Church. What's that? Still have a privy council, yeah. Well, in fact, it's funny that you should ask. I was reading in this book, The Cabal, by Maurice Lee. He talks about, it's got a section on Lauderdale and some of these other English leaders. And they were overthrown, I guess, by the first, in a sense, by the first Earl of Shaftesbury. I was reading the Telegraph last night, this British newspaper, and there was an article on the 10th Earl of Shaftesbury, who's recently, he's on his third wife, and he's 65 and she's 29 or something like that. So he's the 10th, and the first Earl of Shaftesbury is in this book about Charles's reign. So, other questions, comments, etc.? Dr. Rees.
You can see how his character is both attracted to the king and to the same time.
Yeah.
So the king gives him power over the church, for the bishops, because they have political power.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it attracts the wrong sort of people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I was just curious, as clearly the move to ban all the synods was a move to take over the church. Were the synods, I mean, this last bit that you read about the pastors was really it seems like a very strong indictment against the Episcopalian takeover. But I was curious as to whether the synods were at this point concentrating on the work of the kingdom, or if they were sucked into the political equation. Or can you tell that? I'm thinking of the earlier lesson when we saw the Presbyterian ministers on the battlefield, telling the general how to run the battle. And I'm wondering if they at this point were focused or not. So was there any?
Well,
there any
up until the Restoration, right? There'd been. Even though the church, like the General Assembly, couldn't meet, so the highest level of church court was the synods, they'd been quite active in just the work of the gospel. It was a time of a lot of conversions and so on, a lot of teaching and everything. Shortly thereafter, right after the Restoration, they did get caught up, and they're about to be overthrown. So I don't know how much effort they were putting into each part, but and then there was still left over, of course, some of these protest or resolutioner things, which then later became protest or covenant or Episcopalian problems. Because a lot of what happened is and the numbers are, if you look at the numbers ejected from the ministries, it's greater than the number of protesters. But so some of the resolutioners were also ejected. I guess you could say the better resolutioners. But by and large, most of the men ejected were protesters, and then almost all the ones that weren't ejected were resolutioners, or all of them were. So
yeah, just another comment, a thought that came to mind. The Apostle Paul makes a big point of the fact that you ought to pay your pastor. You ought to, that you ought to bring the tithes in and pay the pastor. And we see just from the very beginning the seed of this system where they support even the Presbyterians, I think, support, I mean, or maybe this is not true by this point, even supported the pastor by the taxes in effect, I suppose.
Well, I'm not, yeah, at this point, I'm not really sure. I mean, in fact, in that last, one of the last things we read, the people were banned from paying their pastor their stipends. So I'm not really sure exactly how they were all paid at this point. It's a good question, but
the whole church, if the local churches were paying their pastors, the whole church could have just gone underground, in effect, which I suppose it did to some extent.
Yeah, it did, but they were legally proscribed from paying their ministers. So that presumably that was part of the part of the point that.
Yeah.
So.
It's necessary for
yeah. So. Okay. Well, I think we probably better stop.